Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JP Morgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I am joined by reporter and podcast host, Ested Herndon. Since 2018, he's been a national political reporter for the New York Times, where he's a frequent contributor to the hit show, The Daily. He's also a political analyst over at CNN. When he's not writing for the paper or talking on cable news, he's serving as the host of his own podcast called The Run-Up. Through conversations with Times colleagues, high-ranking political operatives, and a wide array of voters across the country, Herndon attempts to make sense of the current political landscape, with the 2024 election looming large. The Run-Up recently wrapped its latest season, and so it seemed like a good time to sit with Ested and unpack the reporting he's done through the first half of 2023. If you're unfamiliar with his work, I'd encourage you to check out the show, because in a media landscape full of hardened reporters and disingenuous pundits, Herndon cuts through the sound and fury of the 24-hour news cycle. He does this with a mix of passion, skepticism, and curiosity, resulting in what I think is a clear-eyed approach to what he calls grassroots reporting. And so today, on the first half, we discuss the recent impactful decisions issued by the Supreme Court, what to expect from the GOP primaries, and the potential of a third-party ticket. Then, on the back end, we examine Herndon's mission statement as a reporter, what he believes the New York Times has learned since the 2016 election, the role of independent journalism, and who he ultimately makes his work for. As I mentioned at the top of this episode, I was a little bit sick at the time of this recording. I am okay now. I should also mention, before we get rolling, as you've probably seen in the news, the Actors Union, SAG-AFTRA, has joined the WGA in a strike. It is the first time these two unions have actually striked concurrently since 1960. We will be doing an episode on the strike and what it means for the future of film and television later this summer. I saw some people were wondering if this would affect Talk Easy. It does affect the show in that no actors or writers are allowed to be on podcasts or really make any public appearance so long as the strike continues. And so in solidarity with the SAG-AFTRA Union and the WGA, we will not be airing or hosting anyone working basically in film and television, at least in front of the camera. But that said, we will be airing new episodes of the show throughout the summer. We have a whole bunch of conversations planned with musicians, authors, reporters, directors, and a whole lot more. So I hope you stick around for that and enjoy those conversations. If you haven't heard our recent episodes with Tom Hanks, Sarah Silverman, Oscar Isaac, Michael Shannon, Padma Lakshmi, Gina Rosero, Jay Jordan, and really so many more, I'd encourage you to check those out. But for today, here is my conversation with New York Times reporter Ested Herndon. Ested, welcome back. You're talking to a slightly sick Sam. I appreciate you doing it. How's your summer been? Does the New York Times let you take a summer break?
Well, first off, it's good to be back. I don't think we believe in summer break. More so than like, you know, our podcast season just ended. I'm focusing on doing a couple of print stories with the summer. So I've kind of just transitioned to like putting back on my like writer reporter brain. And so as we're planning for our next run of episodes, and especially for the next year, when we really feel like the run up is going to be all intensive. So I have a couple weeks off in August, but as of right now, they've just sucked me into a different part of the institution.
I see. So the official line from the New York Times is, we don't believe in summer.
Yeah. You heard it here first. Summer doesn't exist, according to the gray lady.
As you mentioned, you recently finished the latest season of your program, The Run-Up. Since airing that last episode, the Supreme Court has issued a series of decisions striking down President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, siding with a wedding designer who can now legally refuse to serve same-sex couples, and lastly, ending affirmative action in college admissions. Vice President Harris, in a rare public appearance, has characterized these decisions as being part of a national movement to attack hard-won and hard-fought freedoms. As you can imagine, former President Trump, along with many in the GOP, have praised the court for moving in lockstep with their right-leaning priorities. Broadly, how are you thinking about these decisions and the gulf between those two interpretations from the left and right?
I come at it from a couple different perspectives. One, I think that there is an entrenched conservative majority at the Supreme Court that, frankly, no one can do anything about for the foreseeable future. And so there is a ingrained power structure that really will deliver conservatives wins on a consistent basis. And we can kind of expect that. You know, when we're going into the Supreme Court term, if you ask kind of anybody who was following, they would expect student loans to have fallen. They expected affirmative action to fall. I think for a lot of people, they actually saw their decision in Moore versus Harper and not backing the state legislature's ability to do basically whatever it wants as a small win because of how conservative it is built in. But I think in those reactions, you hear two different responses, partially because they have two different motivations, right? It's not just Harris is coming from an ideological lens. I think you're seeing someone who is hoping that this will galvanize people to support Democrats in next November, in the same way that the Dobbs decision last year really pushed folks to back Democrats in the midterms, or more accurately, reject Republicans in the midterms. And so I think that that's what Harris is trying to do there, saying that there is an entrenched kind of power structure that requires kind of backing and pushing back against conservatives. And she's looking ahead to next November. But I think, well, bigger than either D or R or Trump or Harris is a kind of macro feeling that we focus a lot on in the run-up about how people feel like the political system is completely disconnected from their own desires. How the court is moving in a direction that's completely irresponsive to most of the public's concerns. And there's no really clawback from that. So yeah, you have Harris making the pitch that this is a reason to support Democrats. But I think for most voters, they're getting hip to the idea that even voting for Democrats won't fix that problem. And so that is what I think is the kind of bigger takeaway I had from this court, which I think is in line with what we saw last year and in line for what we talk to people about when they think about the next election. I think there's an increasing feeling of powerlessness from people and an increasing sense that the political system is moving in one direction as the country is asking it to move in another. And so I think the kind of pressures that puts on the larger system is what I'm really trying to focus on, especially, I think, if we end up with a presidential election that's Biden versus Trump again. I think that would add up to a kind of bigger feeling across the country. Like, how did we end up here in a way that, like, people explicitly in 2022 and even in 2020 would have rejected those things? And I think the Supreme Court plays a big role in that because they're another powerful institution that people feel like can do basically whatever it wants, and there's no recourse for the public.
You're talking about a feeling of disillusionment. When we sat down around the midterms last year, you identified four distinct blocks of the electorate: the skeptical Trump voter, the young voter, the disillusioned Democrat, and the non-MAGA Republican. Across these first 6-7 months of reporting, whether it's talking with voters on the ground in Iowa or a variety of operatives across the political spectrum, what shifts are you seeing and hearing in that landscape? Have those four blocks held steady?
It's interesting because I think about the groups we isolated before the midterms, and this midterms was a real grab bag of results. You could tell basically any story you want with those different groups, right? Young people came out in certain states and didn't come out in other states. You had disillusioned Democrats. You had a bad Black voter turnout, while you had actually really enthusiastic Latino voter turnout in key places like Arizona. I think when we think about the midterms largely, ends up being a swing voter story across the country. While you had those different pockets that kind of moved in different directions, what was moving in lockstep is that for persuadable voters, they're kind of classic people who decide, kind of late game breaking voters, in the key races, they overwhelmingly win for Democrats, right? And so that ends up giving us a very clear message on election night about the kind of way those folks were deciding. You know, when we were coming out of the midterms then, we kind of had a challenge of how do we continue to track those groups in an early presidential race period when mostly they're not paying attention, right? So like we had a very grassroots voter focused show going into the midterms, but that's because most people are tuning in at that point. At this point, most people aren't, which is part of the reason we decided to focus this season of the run-up on insiders and the people who were shaping the presidential race using their interpretation of those results, but before most people tuned in. We started our reporting at the RNC winter meeting where they were choosing a chair for the party. And in that kind of race, you basically have a question of how Trumpy should the Republican apparatus be after a midterms that seemed like a rejection of him. But because, you know, what we were talking about last time, the entrenched nature of that power, you've really had the party, I think, over the course of what we've been doing over the last 4 or 5 months, we've seen how they've returned back to him, right? When we started our reporting, Ron DeSantis was being basically anointed on cable news. Donald Trump was saying that he was, you know, costing the party results, that this might be the time they move on, blah, 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 blah. And we kind of start there. But by the time we get to the indictments, by the time we get certainly to going into the summer, not only does DeSantis look individually diminished, but Trump looks stronger, frankly, in the primary context. And I think that that for us was the biggest thing that we had noticed, was that those insiders we were talking to had an investment in Trump that could not be undone by simply the midterm results.
One of the prevailing narratives of 2023, and it began shortly after the midterms in 2022, is that media figures on the left and media figures on the center right have long said that at some point, the fandom and fervor and loyalty to Trump will break. That whether the midterms were a repudiation of Trump or the 2, soon to be 3 indictments, at some point, they will break away from him. And yet, through all of your reporting, there is no indication that that is true. Why is this something that people keep saying?
I have no idea, to be honest with you. I keep encouraging people. I would love to hear people say why they believe that is true. What tells them that, at least in the Republican context, that there is some inevitable breaking point with Donald Trump? Because we know the individual leaders have always been iffy on Trump, because we know that the individual donors, the kind of biggest donors in the party, have often been looking for alternatives. You know, if you're the type of the person who thinks those people decide the direction of politics, then that leads you to that thought. But for me, the overwhelming thing we know from 2016 is that those people don't decide, you know, that these are kind of things, the last 6-8 years have been things happening to them, not things that they've really dictated, right? And so for me, have we had any real evidence that the Republican electorate itself was ready to move on from Trump? The closest we get is after a midterms when he's polling in the 20-30%, right? There was a drop off from him after the midterms.
Mm-hmm.
But that's still not a repudiation. That's still not him being cut out. And that still didn't inherently mean that someone else was going to be able to beat him. Those people, as we're seeing now, some of those people have come back around to him. And so I think there's a little bit of a haughtiness in how political reporting has seen Trump voters that I really dislike, frankly. And I feel like when I talk to Trump voters, the thing that I get is they believe what they're saying. They don't have an uncomfort with the message of Donald Trump. They are actively choosing it. And so because I think people are presuming that they're not making voter decisions in the same way other people do, I think that they think it's, oh, it's just a pizzazz, or it's just a name, or it's just a winning, or it's just a whatever. And I'm like, that's somewhat true, but it's also a real reduction of a conservative electorate that is actively choosing to upend the system and party, and are really proud of the way that he did that.
It sounds like there's a whole lot of wishful thinking on both the left and center right.
One thing, though, is I think it's actually flipped. One of the things we found at the DNC is that Democratic leadership is banking on Donald Trump to be the nominee. And so while I definitely think that there was a wishful thinking on kind of a political media class, what I think has been really emerged in a Biden's version of the Democratic Party is that it's actually helped them reverse a lot of losses they never thought they would have a chance to reverse in the next 15 years. This has them paper over some of Biden liabilities that they thought were going to be much more fatal. And so you actually saw a Democratic Party, I think right now, the thing I get most get from Democrats is Donald Trump is their escape hatch, they think, from November. Now, that's completely disconnected from what it does to the country, what it does to the system, blah, 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 blah. But if you talk to Democrats whose only job is, do we win? They are thrilled. They could not be more excited that the person on the other side is likely Donald Trump.
Well, let's talk about the Democratic Party, because as you mentioned earlier, in poll after poll, it's clear that a unique majority of Americans are against a 2024 presidential race between Biden and Trump. Now, there are some political advocacy groups like No Labels that believes this pervasive disillusionment with both the right and the left clears the lane for a down-the-middle third-party ticket. That would include both a kind of centrist Democrat like a Joe Manchin of West Virginia,
yeah,
and a center-right Republican like Susan Collins of Maine. In a recent episode, you sat down with two members of No Labels, former Senator Joe Lieberman and strategist Ryan Clancy, who both insist that this theoretical third-party ticket would not be defined by social movements or identity politics. Why don't we play a little clip from that?
Yeah. How can there be a unity ticket that steps away from quote-unquote identity politics when that has been some of the biggest drivers of political activism for younger voters over the last 4 or 5 years?
Well, because I think more people are concerned about making our politics more unified and productive than they are devoted to identity politics. One-line answer.
But what's the evidence for that?
Well, it's polling. It's the kind of stuff we've cited here. I mean,
I guess I'm saying like a movement of low income young people or people of color doesn't seem to me to fit with Joe Manchin. That's what I'm trying to square.
Well, here's what I think is really clear from what we looked at in terms of the issues that motivate people. And maybe this gets to the answer of how would it be that a unity ticket could motivate younger voters, people of color. And the simple answer to that is when we look at the issues that are motivating people most, it is overwhelmingly kitchen table. It is everything is too expensive. It is, I don't think I'm going to be better off than my parents were. It is an economic, this is going to be a kitchen table election. And so those, I think, are going to be the issues that are going to motivate people to the extent they're not happy with their current choices.
You sound fairly incredulous in that clip.
I really appreciated them coming and like digging into it. And I think it's a real way that you can explore DC ideas, right? Like, No Labels is a kind of like pet group. We don't exactly know who the funders are. It's a very billionaire-y, like rich folks group. They think the biggest problem in politics is too extreme on the right and the left. And they have correctly identified that because of this kind of dissatisfaction that you're talking about, they have kind of seized this moment as a way to really push that idea of a kind of centrist ticket. What we were exploring there was both their premise of both sidesism, that the right and the left are equally extreme. Someone acknowledged kind of Trump's unique threat to democracy and the like, but they were basically arguing that Black Lives Matter, Sunrise Movement, progressive activists had taken the Democratic Party so far to the left that they could not kind of even ride with Joe Biden's version of the party. But not only were we exploring that, we were trying to explore their solution that they're bringing too. Because when we talk to people who don't like Biden or Trump, they're not often coming from a centrist ideological lens. They're not saying, oh, I don't like these people just because one's to the right, one's to the left. Some of them are saying they're too old. They want a young person. Some of them are saying that they don't believe in the system at all. And they want someone who will, you know, be more anti-government in general. And so when we talk to kind of the disillusioned group, they sound nothing like No Labels. And so what we were trying to do is say, like, even if we take your premise of the problem, which I think the run-up explores, right? We explore people's disillusion and all of that stuff. I don't think they're wrong about that stuff. What I'm saying is, does your solution actually fix that problem? And I think one of the things I really like is after we talk to them, we also go back to a bunch of the voters we had talked to in our polling who had said that they don't like Biden and Trump. And when you read off the name Joe Manchin, half of them don't know who he is. Half of them hate him. Half of them rather The Rock. Half of them rather some guy they have on the radio. Like, the way people think is not from a top-down centrist lens, because they're not thinking the way that, like, D.C. rich folks think. And the reasons people dislike the options are also, for a lot of people, because they dislike the system. And that's something that the no-label solution isn't really wrestling with. And I asked in that interview, like, what does your unity ticket of a DNR think about abortion? They can't say. That's what we're getting at here. It's like the way that people come at these issues from a top-down lens, from a Washington lens, from an insider lens, is so often really disconnected from the way that most people are coming to the same feeling.
I mean, you heard Clancy in that clip say that this election will overwhelmingly be about kitchen table issues. In his thinking, that would be inflation, intergenerational wealth, job security. Those are kind of kitchen table issues. Has any bit of your reporting affirm that to be true?
It's one of those things like, if the economy is bad, it'll matter more than anything, right? But if it's not, that doesn't mean that that matters more than anything. You know what I'm saying? Like, if we have some recession, I do think that would jump to the top of the list, right? Everyone gets all mad. Or gas prices, something the president has barely control over. We saw that really affect people going into midterms.
Which have gone down.
Yeah, which have gone down. But I'm saying, if you take the kitchen table view of the election, you will completely miss the midterms, which for a lot of people was about extremism, about democracy, about all of these other things that weren't considered quote unquote kitchen table. A lot of the people who were saying that were actually calling Biden out before the midterm, saying he was focusing on the wrong thing, that this was going to be an election about inflation and he's busy yelling about democracy. That was the cable news take. And I'm saying, because we talk to people, we know that they're thinking about other things too. And so I think what's wrong is that DC hasn't updated what Americans are talking about at their kitchen tables. And so in that view, you have to think about lower D democracy. You have to think about, you know, gender and sexuality. You have to think about social movements like Black Lives Matter, changing gender roles after Me Too. Like, I think those things were talked about. And for so long, DC has tried to separate culture and politics. I just don't see how a Trump era doesn't shake them from that.
Right.
But for us, I think one of the things I like about audio is you can more deal with the ways that people are coming to political issues from a broader spectrum. And I think a lot of times in print, a lot of times in cable, they still have an outdated view of what kitchen table is.
I think that's true, because in the conversations that you have on the show, I'm always impressed by your capacity to both listen and engage with people across the political spectrum. And you've said in the past that you want to leave interviews in a good place and make sure the audience hears things that land in a place of mutual respect, which if you're thinking about cable news, is a pretty novel concept in media in 2023. How much of this approach is informed by your experiences as a teacher on the north side of Milwaukee, which was then followed by a stint at the Boston Globe as a crime reporter? Did that work prepare you for reporting on the tumult of American politics in 2023?
Oh, absolutely. Right. When I got hired to the Times, I was 25. And like, I had no business covering a presidential election in the traditional sense. But luckily, this is a very non-traditional time. And so all of these experiences for me were so informative about like, how do you see people? How do you hear them? And I think more than anything, like I have a genuine belief that nobody's vote matters more than somebody else's.
You don't think The Rock's vote is more important than my vote?
No, in fact. And so I feel like I remember the kind of view of journalism. This is before, back when I was like, you know, teaching, back when I was doing crime reporting, even like growing up in a community, I would say suburbs of Chicago, like Black suburbs, like I never felt like the version of cable news talked about politics was like the version of politics I experienced, right? And so I'm saying like, it has always been clear to me that so many people weren't feeling talked to in political journalism, right? And so I have the real kind of burning desire to both affirm them and also to put information that I as a reporter feel like is not being explained to them somewhat intentionally. I think the run-up is very open about the fact that we think people are hiding stuff from you. And so I think that like it is on us to put that in language that people find accessible and understand. And I think this is why our show kind of starts with like a very preachy message about systems being broken. I wanted to say like, you can know everything there is to know about national politics. You can know the insiders, you can know all of these people, and it still adds up to the same feeling. It is broken. Like it is not responsive. It actually is built to write out your concerns. Because I actually believe that, I come to people who feel like that and I don't judge them. It's a thing we usually bond over. I get all these questions about like, how do you talk to a Trump voter? And I'm like, they're usually mad and I'm like pretty mad. And like, so we talk about being mad.
That's when conspiracyist Ed comes out.
Yeah, like I'm like, it's not a big leap for me because I feel like I really believe in the like, in the language of politics that has to be universal. You know, like I think for a lot of political journalists, we are oversampled from the same schools and the same identities from the same places. And so when you are going to a church in Iowa, I know the songs. Like my dad was a pastor. When I go to some place in Florida or the South or whatever, those aren't completely foreign to me. And so you have to put yourself in situations that you know nothing about. And I think that's been true, too. But you also have to like legitimately value diverse experiences and legitimately believe that those people have equal say in the system. And so my cause has always been like, if I make things clear, I think people can do with the information what they want to do. To me, the problem is not enough of political journalism, is actively trying to make things clear.
After the break, more from reporter Ested Herndon.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about your cause for a second, because there are times on the show where mutual respect seems a little bit harder to achieve. I'm thinking about an episode you did titled The New Terms of Abortion Politics, where you spoke with the president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. And early on, you asked her to clarify her position around restricting abortion access on a federal level. Why don't we play a clip from that?
Yeah. Do you see something like a 15-week federal limit as the final goal of your organization and how you're pushing Republicans? Or is it a first step for what I hear your personal kind of views are, which is about life beginning at conception? Should we see these kind of pushes as an initial step to an overall goal of limiting abortions at most instances? Or is a 15-week federal consensus where your organization would want the legislation to stop?
Well, I think I was pretty clear, and I can answer it again. And I know you're trying to be helpful to your cause to try to get to a place of fear. But I'm
not trying to be helpful to a cause. I'm trying to be clear. So I'm asking the question not because of any cause.
Yeah, you're on a cause, but that's okay. Because I have a cause too. You have a cause, even though you're a journalist. So let me just get to actually what
my cause is. Transparency. That's why I'm asking.
Good. I'm going to say it one more time, that our job in the pro-life movement and in the country in general is to get to America's consensus on this issue, finally allow it to establish its way into the law through the will of the people. And 15 weeks is the most modest place that we could land if we're going to be ambitious from the pro-life movement perspective, be as ambitious as we can. And no matter where we land, it will not outstrip the will of the people of the country. And if it does in some way, the democratic process is here and available for the will of the people to speak once again.
What do you make of that?
I mean, there was a couple moments like this in the season. We had some tense moments with the RNC chair. We had some with Mike Lindell. We had some with some Democrats, too.
I heard them all.
I think that, like, it's interesting because I don't know how you feel about podcast, but like, I'm very much like in a bubble. I'm not really thinking in those moments about those being played. These moments happened in interviews all the time when I was a print reporter. And you power through them because I am someone who will talk to anyone. Like, I gave Stephen Miller my card like 3 months ago.
I'm sorry.
My premise in doing that is that nobody's going to get off easy. We're going to ask the stuff we want to ask, right? To me, that is the only way you gain trust as someone who does talk to everyone, right? Let's talk about that clip specifically. We didn't just have that moment, though. Like, she had asked me earlier to not use federal ban, but to say abortion limit. Now, I could have picked a fight then. I felt like a moment of tension would come in the future, so let me bank my respect points early. And so I used limit. Even in that question, I used limit. And at the end of that interview, so we end in a fine place. She actually apologizes a little for like getting upset. And I always try to make clear with people, like, I do not take that personally. I understand that you're doing your job. I'm doing my job. And so like, I am not taking this as like an individual upset. But I will have to say that like, it's interesting to me because when people have heard this, I think it shows how rare it is that we see people in this kind of like and we hear journalists doing this. And I didn't really know that people were going to come to that in that way.
Right.
But I think I like that it comes up a bunch because I want people to know it's not like easy getting these people to say this stuff. And like, that is why to me, like, we have this feeling of they're hiding it and we got like whatever, is because you actually hear them not wanting to say it. And I think that's the thing that I also love about audio is like, you know that by the time I ask the RNC chairwoman, is she going to change their position if Donald Trump gets indicted? That is a question they do not want asked. And you hear them push back against even that, even though it feels intuitive for most people. Or it's something that I'm sitting with in the interview. Like, I'm sitting there thinking like, okay, she's talking about this 15-week limit, but does that stop there? If I can't leave that interview without me knowing, I'm going to make sure I get my answer too. But it's funny, like, you know, I don't want to be a hater. I have a dueling angel demon between like my Midwestern niceness and like my journalistic haterness. I'm not trying to fight. I'm not trying to beef. I don't. But if you want beef, if you're seeking beef, we can have it, you know?
I like the dueling aesthetics. I think I've heard that even on this episode of the show. And that clip, I'm glad you said that because there's a reason I wanted to highlight it here on our program. But she does say, like her, you, Estelle Herndon, and the New York Times have a cause.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think she thinks your cause is?
Well, you know, from a conservative lens, she thinks the New York Times is liberal, that the New York Times is pushing fear-mongering of, like, Republicans. The thing I most get is not just, like, New York Times is a secret liberal reporter, but when people see Black people, they assume that that is just, like, doubled by five. And I'm not saying that's happening with her, because I don't actually know if that's happening with her. That happens to me all the time, is the people's, like, presumed liberalness is not only because of Timesness, but because of Blackness. Also, journalists have been uncomfortable with the idea of owning the fact that they do have a cause. And so there's been this like push and pull in the industry about whether you can be a journalist and have a cause. I have never found that to be that interesting of a combo because I believe that's the only reason to do this job. In my role, it's not ideological driven. It's transparency driven. It's fact driven. It's fairness driven. But like those are causes. You know, Ida B. Wells had a cause, you know, like the Chicago Defender had a cause, right? That cause was justice. That cause was transparency. That cause was saying things that other people wouldn't say that were truthful. And so I've always felt fine with that idea because I feel like it still adds up to fairness, right? It still adds up to something that's truthful and contextual. And I trust that in that process, that's still journalistic. But I do think that a lot of times activists have pushed us around because they throw this label of cause on you. And I think too many journalists have run from that rather than actually embracing that challenge, right? To me, the best journalists I've ever known all had causes. They were all angry. They were all mad. They were all doing something based out of a sense of mission. If I didn't care, I would simply do something that like didn't cause me so much emotional stress, right? Like, so like to me, the only reason to do it is because of said cause.
How do you square away your cause with the sentiments from your publisher, A.G. Sulzberger? He recently wrote an essay in the Columbia Journalism Review where he wrote, "There will be no worthwhile future of journalism if our profession abandons the core value that makes our work essential to democratic society. That value is journalistic independence. Independence is the increasingly contested journalistic commitment to following the facts wherever they lead."
Yeah.
And, you know, it's worth noting, when Sulzberger's great-great-grandfather assumed control of the Times in 1896...
Love Sulzberger fun facts.
He said that the role of the paper is to give news impartially, without fear or favor, regardless of party, sect, or interest involved. So it seems like the current Sulzberger is echoing the very sentiments that his great-great-grandfather expressed 127 years ago. How do you square away your cause with that mission statement?
I don't see them as incompatible. I frankly think the run-up is a model of journalistic independence. I think in that cause, we follow the facts where they go. I think particularly in political reporting, there has been a desire to kind of calibrate yourself in the middle for a sense of kind of like performative objectivity, right? And I think what we don't do is act like D and R are all the same. I don't think that we run from asking tough questions of both, but I think we make sure that those are questions that are not only based in relationship to one another, but also seeing them in isolation, right? So we have those DNR episodes where one Democrat speaks, one Republican speaks, but we also have episodes focused on Democrats themselves. And I think that's actually important to separate them from Republicans. There was a line in that AG Journalistic Independence that I think about where he was like, we're never going back to the pre-2016 universe.
What do you think he means by that?
I think that there has been a shift in understanding what the pitfalls of performative objectivity. I think that there is a clear understanding of that. And so for me, I don't think I would exist at the New York Times. Let me be careful here. I don't think I would exist at the Times if there wasn't some level of commitment to pushing things wherever they go. What I do as a reporter, though, all right, let me tell this a more specific way.
This is the first time you've been stumped on something. What do you have to be careful about here?
Well, I want to make sure I say things clearly because I feel like I want to be a model for how journalistic independence works. And so I want to make sure that I'm expressing how I view that within the Times and saying that clearly. And so one thing, an example I'll give is I used to always get the question about using racist in stories, right? The word, like describing things as racist. And I remember in Trump era, a huge kind of journalistic discussion about when we describe things as such. And I remember kind of internally advocating for us to be willing to use some of those descriptors even more. That's a battle we've kind of lost. And so I did a set of stories about white identity for the time, like white identity politics leading the Republican Party. I went to Trump stock as white nationalist fest. I went to St. Cloud, Minnesota, where they were trying to kick immigrants out of their town. I went to Pennsylvania where this guy was running a campaign that was based off of this like anti-Muslim sentiment, right? All specifically to do how white identity politics was an organizing principle of Trumpism at its core. And in those stories, I never used the word racist. And no one ever cares. No one ever brings it up when they read it. No one ever misses it.
Did you want to?
I don't know. I knew I couldn't. But to me, that's not that big of a deal. You go do the reporting that says what you want to say, and no one misses it. To me, that's the thing. If I wanted to go work at a Black institution where you can say the fullness of whatever, those places exist, and I love the reporters who do that and make that choice. I'm saying, I know that I'm working for a New York Times who cares about the ways that things come to the country broadly. And to me, that puts a reporting onus of me to work within that premise, and you can. And so one of the things that Dean, our former editor, always said was about how the Times completely missed the Great Migration, mostly, was because they didn't know Black people. And so you missed the biggest domestic mass migration in the country's history. How good of a journalist are you? That's not you following facts wherever they go. And so for me, the values of diversity, the values of including new voices, the values of bringing people to the table who have not been there are core journalistic necessities and actually makes your journalism more independent, right? And so I have always found that to work within the premise, but it does, I think, put onus on you as a reporter. Now, if you're going to talk about things like race, identity, gender, sexuality, and you want to go there, it's important for me to physically go there and to get reporting that really proves that stuff. And I really feel like in the run-up, I want us to get to next November, and it's actually a model for how you can be hard, you can get to new information, you can include people who are left out of the process, and all of that is just as New York Times as all the things that we have typically thought of as that.
So I see the distinction you're making. I guess I want to know, you know, former editor James Bennett, who was asked to resign, said that post-2016, the New York Times had signed up so many new subscribers that the expectation of those subscribers is that the Times will be Mother Jones on steroids.
I can't speak to what he thought. I personally did not think that was true. One, that's not my job. But two, like, I didn't see that.
That assessment is just wrongheaded then.
I don't think that assessment's wrongheaded. I think that is an op-ed editor who thinks differently about news and journalism. I think about the paper. And so for me, the 2016 story was a story of political media completely missing the country. And that is everywhere and including us.
What do you mean by that?
I mean by if you look at the 2016 GOP primary, Donald Trump had no chance. If you look at the 2016 Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders was irrelevant. If you look at the 2016 general election, they thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. So I'm saying every step of the way, conventional wisdom was incorrect because every step of the way, they were completely disconnected from the mood of the majority of the electorate. Now, why did that happen? In my opinion, that happens because a political ecosystem had missed the changes in second term Obama era, had believed way too much in demographic destiny, did not know what those people are, what they cared about. They were too rich. They did not know poor people. They did not know the mass disillusion with Hillary Clinton. All of those things to me are macro, huge things that, but to me, come down to a core of like, you didn't ask. Whoever was leading the train and telling you what this country felt was completely incorrect. And so for me, that has been the driver of the reason to do bottom-up reporting. It's like, these people at the top, I have to know what they're thinking for campaigns, I have to know all that, but they could be just as wrong, and they're often just as wrong, and they're increasingly wrong. I remember where I was in 2016 in Boston thinking, oh, this profession is completely out of whack with the country. And so I think by the time I come there in 2018, I was very explicit to anyone who would ask that I wanted to try something different, that I wanted to report different types of stories. And all I'm saying is, like, if that was incompatible with the New York Times, I wouldn't be here. And so when AG lays out in that thing and says, we need to talk to evangelicals, we need to talk to poor people, non-college folks, low-income people of color, that's all my language. That's all things that I really believe. I think we have to acknowledge how recent it is that those things are said out loud.
Let's hear an example of that belief, because in the last episode of the season, you went down to Iowa ahead of the caucuses in early 2024. And during that visit of yours, you sat down with Jesse Newman.
Mm-hmm.
He's an Australian pastor who actively folds politics into his sermons. Someone who has said openly that the role of the church is to correct the culture. He's already endorsed Governor DeSantis for 2024, although he admitted he would stand behind former President Trump should he be the nominee.
He said he was 51-49.
And in this clip, towards the end of your conversation with him, he's talking about how Democrats, especially in the White House, have drifted further and further to the left.
Like, when people say things like the Republican Party has moved right, I don't think it has. We just win sometimes now. I think the Democratic Party's moved left. And, you know, I think it'd be pretty hard to prove they haven't. Like, today I see that the White House lit up with rainbows, and that the White House, right, that half the country doesn't agree with. But he's like, let's just roll that up there on the White House, level with the American flag. They didn't used to be pro-gay marriage. They didn't used to be pro-gender dysphoria as a blessing rather than a illness to be solved. They didn't used to be pro unlimited abortion, pretty much. So, you know, they used to, safe, rare, and legal was Joe Biden back in the
Clinton,
day, was Clinton, was Obama. That's what they all said.
Okay, so there's a couple things here.
Yeah.
Initial thoughts, hearing that again.
It's crazy. I don't really listen after they're out.
This is what I'm here for.
I'm like, oh man. His sermon, I mean, we went to the whole service, right? As you somewhat heard in there. But like, we had learned going in that he was like, the word we got was, oh, he's really right wing. And you could tell that in his sermon, he was trying to be on his best behavior because he knew the Times was there. And then in that interview, it just all jumped out. But you could tell I hear myself encouraging it to jump out because I knew it was there.
That's what I want to ask you about.
Yeah, go ahead.
When Newman says things like, the White House is lit up with rainbows, half the country doesn't agree with that. Or Democrats used to not be pro-unlimited abortions. In both cases, there's no evidence to support those claims. In fact, poll after poll show that 65 to 71% of Americans are pro-gay marriage, more than half than he suggests. Moreover, the White House and the Biden administration has never endorsed unlimited abortions or framed gender dysphoria as a blessing, as Newman said. So as he's putting those claims on the record that are demonstrably false, did you not feel it was your place to push back with what you know is the truth, with the facts?
There are places that I do push back and there's places I let people cook. I am very rarely trying to engage people in the facts of their belief. And so even with Marjorie Dannenfelser, I was not engaging her in the facts of how she describes abortion access or the facts of how she described conception, you know? And so what I push people on is the politics. We really wrestle with this. We have a fact checker, right, who gets mad at us all the time. We basically go through, and in places that there is a demonstrably false thing or it's like stat-sided, is mostly taken out. So we have like a limit to what people can get away with. But you're right, correctly identifying that I do let people say falsehoods.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess for me, the show has a very clear focus. The focus is not what do people believe. It is how hearing their beliefs and hearing how they are using them in the election. And so for me, I am often trying to get people to be as explicit about their beliefs as possible, rather than I'm trying to get them to deal with the fact or fiction of their beliefs. Now, that's not always true, because I feel like, and particularly with like larger political figures, I do more pushing back. In this, I can tell you what I was thinking, which is like individual pastor feels different. It feels like talking to a voter. I very rarely in voter convos deal with facts.
You're making a distinction between everyday voters and someone like former Senator Joe Lieberman.
Yeah, or even more so than that. I'm saying RNC chairwoman, Mike Lindell, whatever, whatever. And I'm saying you could kind of argue that this pastor has political power in like a whatever way. So I could see how like that's not maybe not a fully satisfying thing. But in my head, he's not the same type of person. But I'm saying I have a much higher willingness to let misinfo come from individuals. And we get pushback. I mean, last year when we had our two episodes of Just Voters, the one with Republicans, we got a lot of pushback and a lot of people also who really loved it, right? I hear the arguments. My basic feeling is because it's an elections-focused show, that for most people who are coming to it as like individual voter, I want to be tailored to how that's impacting things. So actually a good example is like, you know, last year we had on Al Mohler from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And that was our kind of our first dealing with this. And he said a lot that was, I would say, straight up discriminatory. I remember the prep for this interview, and I remember getting really frustrated because I was like, y'all, like, the questions that some of us are trying to do here are basically just asking him, why does he believe what he believes? And I don't think that's our show. I think our show is, how are your beliefs impacting others? And showing that through the election. And so, can that have more pushback in it and still be achieved in that pastor interview? Probably. But I'm saying I'm coming to him thinking more as individual voter and kind of representative of a community where I want the explicitness. And then I, in my head, I move on.
I see the trade-off. But when you hear that back, as you just did for the first time, probably since you made it, do you think there is a danger in platforming someone who is actively misleading listeners on these points? Like, we talked earlier about your ability to stay open and listen and respond, but at what point does accommodation turn into acquiescence?
I think if the episode ends there, or if it's just an episode about him, then that's true. I think we're really intentional about why people are used.
Right.
That episode is structured around a very specific point around Republicans and what evangelicals are trying to push within Trump. And I think that purpose for me rises past the point about platforming and acquiescence. This came up again with Mike Lindell. He said a lot of false things about the election. You know, people talk about acquiescence. I'm like, the purpose of him on there is because we also pair him with Ronna McDaniel and then go ask her about it. For me, we ask this question a lot to ourselves. And they back me off of so many ledges. Like, when I say I would be way worse, I want to talk to way worse people.
What ledges have they walked you off of?
I'm saying there's not a person I wouldn't who would say yes.
Why do you get pushed off that?
Because I think, to your point, there's a real fear about acquiescence. There's a real fear about platforming.
A fear you don't have, though.
It's not my main concern. My main concern is that people underknow. But it's not that I don't have that fear. That, to me, is not as big of a deal as the thing I care more about, which is I think we under-acknowledge how much explicitly discriminatory or bigoted language or explicitly conspiratorial thinking or people who have are all impacting this. And so for me, I'm like, I'm going to show that. And so that's how I'm thinking about it. Let's go back to the white identity stories.
Right.
These people were saying the N-word to my face. I was like, score. Why else am I at a white nationalist rally? So I'm saying that requires editing, though. That's why I would have a horrible Substack, right? Like, it requires a team. It requires me having people around. It was like, no, that's actually too much.
This is how we know. If Estead ever has a Substack, we know he's fallen off the deep end.
No, 100%. I will never. I'm saying like it would never be my main. I know it wouldn't. I would say things I shouldn't say or don't want to say, or I need that. I need help. You know, I don't get why. I don't know why everyone else thinks they don't, but I know I do. So I'm saying like it's not that I don't care about platforming. It's that I super care about other stuff. And so I see our big role over the next year and a half at the Times being the home of mess in a good journalistic way. All I'm saying is like, I don't think like, oh, we platformed a bad guy. I think we have to think about purpose with them. I think I do have to think about pushback. And I think we have to think about rounding out the type of voices we hear. And so there was a point midway through the season where my mom texts me, if you have another Republican only episode, I'm going to stop listening. It was basically that, right? And I'm like, that is true. We've only been dealing with this one side. We need to have Hunt and Slotkin. We need to have Castro. We need to have like people who actually round this out and tell us about the impacts of these things. And it's not just, you know, hearing CPAC over and over.
Yeah. Tell me this is true. The Home of Mess, was that your original idea for the title of the show?
I actually wanted to call it Both Sides.
Oh, no.
I know. I was totally talking. Again, this is why I need editors. Just talk to out of legends, you know? Like, I was like, yeah, everyone's already making fun of the Times anyway for Both Sides. Like, let's just call ourselves Both Sides. But everyone's like, no.
Wow. That would have 8 downloads, I'm going to tell you right now.
I'm on ideas. Like, I'll give out 20 of them and like 2 of them are good, you know?
You could also call the show The Quiet Part Out Loud.
Yeah.
That seems to be the mission statement.
Yes. I think this is an election, though, where the quiet parts are really loud, right? And so I think that we are really built to say the things people are feeling, but media ecosystem ain't talking about. And so, you know, my other life is CNN political.
Yeah, I've seen y'all that you're wearing suits on there.
I can cosplay also, you know? And so I'm saying, like, I often leave there thinking about run-up episodes because it reminds me of what's not talked about. The ecosystem has all decided this one thing, and it has always been my mission, whether in the paper or in audio, that I wasn't going to do that thing.
As we go, let's look ahead a little bit, because at the end of the finale of this new season, you said, as we head into the summer and fall, when the race begins in earnest, I wonder if the majority of voters are going to be alarmed to discover that what so many of them explicitly rejected in the midterms is exactly what 2024 is going to be about. What did you mean by that?
I'm thinking about the people who don't listen to our podcast, the people who aren't engaged. You know, I'm thinking about when I was at my dad's church on Sunday and this lady comes up to me and is like, no way Biden's running again. I'm like, yeah, he's actually already announced. I think about those people all the time. And I think for the majority of people, neither side of this equation has really set in. And both the reality of Biden's reelection and the reality for all the legal challenges, for all the political challenges, Donald Trump is very likely, especially what he is about, is almost certainly going to be what the nominee is about, even if it's not him. In the universe, it's not him. And so the biggest story of the next year and a half, if it is Donald Trump versus Joe Biden again, is going to be about Americans' disillusion and Americans' despair over system, which is where we started our show. And so that's what I mean, is for a midterms that was uniquely universal in its rejection of this, it's still going to come around to a presidential election that's an intensified version of Trumpism. Donald Trump and what conservatives on that kind of wing are doing is an escalated version of what we heard in 2016, what we heard in 2020. And I guess I really wanted to needle the insiders who have been clamoring for this. The D's who want Trump so they can win, and the R's who want Biden because they think it helps Trump win. That's a view of politics that does not include anybody on the ground. It doesn't include what they care about, and it doesn't include their main voice, which is that they wanted something different. I want to re-remind people about that disconnect in focusing on insiders and the proof points that come through about how they view the next year and a half purely through this kind of blackjacky game. I don't want to end there. I want to end with how that game leaves a whole bunch of people out of the table. That disconnect between who's there and who's not there and the gulf in their desires, I think will become very clear and is going to be really explosive in the next year. And I just think the insiders we talk to don't deal with that fact. They just worry about who wins, which is their job.
As someone who's threading the needle between those two, and spending time with both the political operatives and a whole host of normal, everyday voters across the country. That existential despair, do you think people come back to the blackjack table, or do they upend the table? Do they walk out of the casino? How do we square this away?
I don't know. I think there's the electoral answer, which is that people made very clear that they can be dissatisfied and still vote for somebody. And I think that's a real reality of the last like 4-something years, right? This does not mean that Joe Biden loses the election. That's not what we're saying. We don't know. I think what I'm saying is like, I don't think who wins is going to be what we remember about next year. Or it will be, obviously. The things that are going to drive day-to-day mood about the election, the things that might drive people's actions about the election, the kind of unpredictable nature of what might happen. I think all of that will flow out of that disillusioned reality. People ask about third party. That's the reason we have to explore, because who knows? Or people ask about, you know, will age cause people to back someone who's been indicted? I don't know. All of those things, though, are completely distinct from the quote-unquote kitchen table, you know, to use Ryan Clancy's language. And so, like, I don't think I have a clear sense of what people do with that dissatisfaction. All I'm saying is, like, if that is the overwhelming, prevailing feeling, we already saw in 2016 how that can lead to really unpredictable things happening.
You know, we've been circling this idea of disillusionment that feels pretty pervasive right now. And I wondered if you yourself, in continuing to do this work, have felt that same feeling of disillusionment. And if you have, how do you keep beating back against it?
I do it because I'm disillusioned. It's why I became a journalist. Like, I was in college thinking I wanted to work in politics, though. I had been like an Obama generation Chicago person.
Same.
And that, I don't even mean that in the democracy, in the Democrat sense. I mean that in the hope sense.
And a Bulls fan sense, but yeah.
And a Bulls fan sense and the Sox fan sense. I'm saying, though, look, I was just home over the weekend and like everything is closed. The people who were broke in those communities are still broke, right? I remember in college, I thought I wanted to work on this like campaign, right? I don't know if this is going to get me in trouble again, but here we go. And I remember I was like kind of tasked with going to these Black communities and telling them that this vote was going to improve their community. And I knew that was false. I knew it. I knew it.
Did you do it anyway?
Yeah, but that was like, I'm never again. You know, the ship has already sailed on my disillusion. The run-up is about broken systems because of that disillusion. I thought I needed to go to audio and get out the paper to more deal closely with disillusion. That's why I care so much about affirming the way people feel about it. Because I honestly think too much of political media gaslights them out of that feeling. They tell them they're dumb for acting disillusioned, right? Like, so much of politics media is telling people that really the smart people know they care and the dumb people think it's broken. And I don't think that's true. So disillusion doesn't mean it doesn't matter. I think it really matters, but I get why people hate it. I get why people say it doesn't work, because for the vast majority of people, it doesn't. And for the vast majority of people, it's not created to work for them. And so that's my point in like doing this, is for all the people I grew up with, right? And so, you know, when I go to church on Sunday, you know, Sister Shauna tells us how much she loves our podcast, how much she learns from it, how she's never thought about politics like this. That's why I'm doing it, is because that is embarrassing for journalism. That should not be that rare. You know, you find yourself as someone from those places in this position, like I care about affirming how they feel. And the vast majority of the people from the people I care the most about feel like this has never been set up to work for them.
Well, I just want to thank you for this latest season and for caring in a time where that's increasingly harder and harder to do. And I know that care does not get a summer break, but I hope you find some pause and some refuge in this time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate like asking and thinking about all through this stuff. And I feel like I have a special love for people who like cared about us in season one. Like more people care about us now, but like you were there, OG. So I really appreciate that. So thanks. And I hope the sickness clears up too.
Thank you. Until next time, Ested Herndon, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. We'll be right back.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. I want to give a very special thanks this week to our guest, Stead Herndon. To learn more about him and his work, you can visit our website at talkeasypod.com. If you haven't checked out the latest season of his excellent podcast, The Run-Up, you can do so wherever you are listening to this right now. If you enjoyed today's episode and want to hear more like it, I'd check out my talks with Ezra Klein, Kara Swisher, Congressman Maxwell Frost, Neil Katyal, Sarah Nelson, and Maria Ressa. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to support Talk Easy by purchasing one of our mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with writer Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. That's TalkEasyPod.com/shop. As always, Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editors are Clarice Guevara and C.J. Mitchell. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries, Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Navarez, Kira Posey, Tara Machado, Maya Koenig, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Lital Malad, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with another episode. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.